this problem solver sort of default mindset, we kind of need to overcome it, especially when we're dealing with other people and their challenges, that first and foremost, they're people. And that means they are feeling things and they are struggling with things. And that is probably more important than the problem itself.
From Bright Umbrella, this is Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we have Jamie Strawn on the show to discuss mental wellness and debugging your feelings. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
Today's episode is sponsored by the .all Conference. The first annual .all Conference for craft developers is less than 2 weeks away. This year's conference is taking place October 22nd and 23rd in Portland, Oregon, and will feature a Craft 3 workshop led by Ryan Ireland of Majingo, a plugin development lab, and a full day of sessions relevant to craft and web development. Tickets are still available at dotall.com. That's dotall.com. Hope to see you there.
Today, we are talking about mental health. It is a topic that's really close to me. I studied psychology in undergraduate school and a bit for graduate, and I've been receiving some type of mental health therapy on and off for about 15 years. I believe mental wellness and health is as important as our physical wellness and health, and the month of October happens to include World Mental Health Day and Mental Illness Awareness Week. So with all that in mind, we have special guest Jamie Strawn here to help us debug our feelings. Jamie currently manages a team of developers at Infotech Research Group after spending 15 years as a web developer himself. He strives to help those around him by being a facilitator, an advocate, and an advisor, and shares his experience with depression to help combat the stigma surrounding mental health issues. Welcome to the show, Jamie.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, Jamie, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
Yeah, so career-wise, that introduction was pretty accurate. I've been in web development mostly as a front-end developer for most of my career, about 15, 16 years since I got out of university. And that was, I've been doing development for like a big bank in Canada, a small agency. I worked for the Canadian Public Broadcaster for a number of years. And if you had asked me at any point whether I was going to get into management, the answer probably would have been no. Until about a year ago or a year and a half ago, I really started thinking about it. My roles had been getting away from sort of more technical stuff and into more leadership stuff. And I found that I actually liked that. So yeah, earlier this year, I got my first job as a manager working at Infotech Research Group, which has been really interesting and challenging and different, but so far so good. And through a lot of that, I've also been doing quite a bit of public speaking. So last couple of years, I've been speaking at sort of a handful of conferences or meetups and things every year. And so I think part of the reason why I'm on the show today is because of a talk that Leah saw me give in Seattle at Peers Conference earlier this year on this topic, on debugging our feelings and mental health. And like I say, I'd done a bunch of speaking, and a lot of it was very technical, talking about object-oriented CSS or Agile or, you know, Grunt plugins and things like that. And after doing that for a little while, I kind of got not sick of it, but it wasn't really appealing to me much anymore. I didn't know what I wanted to talk about. And so I was just going to take a little break. And then I had this sort of moment, this epiphany where I realized that the depression that I've been dealing with for, I'd say, most of my adult life had these sort of interesting parallels with the work that I was doing as a developer. And I think the sort of developer culture and the types of people that I think developers often tend to be. And so I started building a talk around it. And like I say, I've been giving it for the last year or so in various formats. And I don't think it was something that I set out to like have really lofty goals about. I just thought it was a really cool idea. But it's turned into something a lot bigger and something that I'm really actually interested and happy to talk about now. And it's kind of the only talk I give anymore. And it's the only one I pitch because I feel so strongly about it. And I think it's so important.
That's a really interesting evolution. If you don't mind me asking, I'm curious how it all started. How did you get started on the web in the first place?
So I feel like my family's had a computer sort of forever. So I remember noodling around in BASIC and stuff as a kid. But I remember when I was in high school, this is 1997, I was in a sort of final year computer class. And for our project, we ended up getting an assignment to build a website for one of our team members' dads, which in retrospect, I'm not sure that that's how that was supposed to work. But he got a website out of it. But this is sort of like, this is well before a lot of back-end technology and stuff was in place. So we used a tool called Hot Metal, which I'm not sure anybody has ever used since, for building just like very basic web pages. And that's where I sort of got started in HTML and the web. And I went to school for computer engineering, which is sort of a gamut from, you know, hardware all the way up to software development. Mm-hmm. And it was a co-op program, which meant that I did 4 months at school and then switched off 4 months at a job and did that for sort of 5 years. So I ended up with 2 years of experience by the time I graduated, which was incredible. But a lot of that experience was finding things that I did not want to do when I got out of school. So it was really useful for sort of crossing things off the list. But I had one job as a web developer actually in the Canadian government and really got into how sort of tangible and immediate web development was, like, you know, being able to actually make a change in your code and see it right away. A lot of the other stuff I'd done was sort of lower level back-end programming. And I remember doing one co-op term for 4 months where we were working on kind of an internet phone application. And we spent 4 months, a team of us writing C++, trying to get a phone to ring. And we sort of finally did at the end, but it felt very unsatisfying for me. It just seemed like a whole lot of work to get to this point that, I mean, was a real achievement, but also like, it's just very hard for me to feel excited about that stuff. So the web was like, hey, yeah, you change one character in your code and like you can immediately see what happens. Mm-hmm. So that part I loved. And so after I got out of school, that's exactly what I looked for, was how I could get into web development, sort of who was hiring, what kinds of things I could do, and really learned a lot on the job as well, which was great.
So before we dive into our topic today, I just wanted to have a note to our listeners. General, you know, the legal ease. We are not mental health experts. We're not doctors. Jamie, Leah, and I are going to share our personal experiences and strategies that work for us. If you as a listener are struggling with your own mental well-being, please reach out to professionals. And we're going to be sure to include links in the show notes to some reputable organizations with resources. So with that all set aside, Jamie, let's talk a little bit about basics. I mean, how would you define mental health? I think that's something that I don't think a lot of people actually have a clear definition of.
Well, maybe disappointing to hear that. I'm not sure I have a clear definition of either. I've been sort of thinking about, having been, I guess, cognizant of my mental state for, I mean, many years now, just being aware, having gotten a diagnosis of depression sort of 16 years ago, it's made me a lot more aware of sort of how I'm feeling and how I'm doing and what's working and what's not working. Possibly more than people who sort of haven't really had to struggle with that kind of thing in, you know, with the kind of severity or the duration that I have. So for me, one of the things I really emphasize is the idea that our feelings and our responses are helping us. And I've heard it described that people are just kind of thought machines, which is totally true, that we just think a lot. It's kind of what we do. And that thinking leads to feeling, and that feel. So we're sort of often feeling things, and we have a wide range of, you know, emotional response. And that's all good. That's all part of being human. But that doesn't necessarily mean that all those thoughts and those feelings are helping us, you know, move closer to our goals and our objectives and really living towards our values. So to me, that's the first kind of rubric of test, is to make sure that those things that we're feeling are really helping us, right? Are really useful in what we're trying to achieve. That's, you know, it's not always easy and it's not necessarily always clear cut. But I think, you know, things get a lot worse and a lot more dangerous when the feelings we have are really holding us back from the stuff that we know we want to do, right? So mental health is sort of not just being in a state where our feelings are sort of are helping us or buoying us, but also having some awareness around how we're feeling and how we're thinking and being able to understand for ourselves, you know, are we in a good place? Are the thoughts and feelings that we're having being helpful to us? Are they reasonable and rational? Because I think, you know, without some of that self-awareness, it can be very difficult to even know where you stand and to have any kind of perspective on whether or not what you're feeling is legitimate, is necessary, is, you know, what you could or should be feeling at that point, right? Like, I think it's one thing that's very true for a lot of people that when you start feeling something, right, start getting overwhelmed by depression or anxiety, but even just, you know, being nervous or afraid or angry, it's very hard to see that what's going on is something that could be changed or something that might not be helping you. You just, it feels like this is it. This is necessary. This is how it has to be. It's important. It's real. And so another aspect of health is sort of being able to step back from that and saying, okay, you know, I'm having these thoughts, I'm having these feelings, but they aren't me and they aren't, strictly speaking, truth. They aren't necessary. They don't define what it is that I'm going through. And then we can sort of make choices around how we want to deal with that, as opposed to just getting sort of caught up in it.
Yeah, absolutely. I would have to say that you're the first person I've ever heard speak about this topic so candidly, especially in a developer focused conference. And I found it really, really refreshing. But I mean, clearly, it's also still a very sensitive topic. You kind of touched on it earlier about, like, you know, like you said, you weren't like tired of talking about tech topics, but you were ready to try something new. But why speak about mental health so candidly to this audience, to this industry? What's been the reception?
So I'll come back to the reception. The reception has been really, really good. But sort of how I decided to do it, I was thinking about this and I don't know that it was an incredibly conscious decision at any point that, like, yes, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be, you know, sort of an advocate for this stuff. Like I said earlier, I sort of got enamored with the idea of talking about it and making it very relatable for developers. Again, I've lived a good deal of my life in kind of developer world, and that affects how I think, how I solve problems, how I relate to people, the kind of, you know, challenges I choose to take on. And I realized that there were these parallels between those aspects of myself and the kinds of tools and strategies I'd found to help deal with depression. And that was really the genesis of this idea, like, oh, well, this problem that I've had, this depression that I've faced for so long, it felt like I could flip the script a bit and almost turn what had been this challenge into sort of a superpower. Like being able to say, like, you know, I had very much felt that because I was dealing with all this depression, that it was sapping my energy. It was making everything harder for me. It was meaning that I couldn't, you know, achieve as much as I wanted to achieve. And this was the first time that I kind of thought, like, this actually gives me something that I can teach other people about, right? That I can connect to other people about this thing that I've been looking at as sort of a weakness, a bad thing, and actually maybe flip it into sort of a strength. So again, I don't know if I thought about this stuff really, really consciously before I started giving the talk, but the first time I gave a talk, I did sort of a dry run at my last job before I went to speak at a conference. And just talking about the response, like, there were people that came up to me afterwards, and I talk very candidly about the fact that I was diagnosed with depression. I still struggle with it. And there were a number of people that came up to me afterwards and were surprised by the fact that that was something I was facing. It wasn't something I'd really sort of worn on my sleeve, I guess. And I tend to be pretty, let's say, high functioning. I also am very sort of stoic. I don't want people to know when I'm struggling. That's kind of me. I don't think that's a great instinct, but it's mine. And that made me think, like, I wonder how many other people out there are suffering from this stuff or facing these challenges and nobody knows about it, because it can feel so isolating. You can feel really ashamed, right? About the fact that you're dealing with this stuff and it seems like everyone else is fine. And that makes it even worse, right? Then you're judging yourself, thinking, oh, why is nobody else having these problems when I am? And, you know, that makes me even weaker. And so after having done the talk a little bit and hearing from people, like, oh, I really heard myself reflected in some of those things you were talking about, like, a lot of your experiences really spoke to the experiences that I'm having, I kind of realized how important it was for me to share this stuff so that, again, it would be able to connect with other people, but also to kind of expand the space for this conversation, to let people know that it's, you know, not ideal, but okay, that, you know, we're facing these things. That may not be all the time, and it may not be as severe as someone else. But I think we all go through challenges. I think that's sort of human nature. And sort of talk about tools and techniques that we can use to deal with those, I think, seems like a really important thing. I think the other thing that I sort of realized, and this has been dawning on me more recently, is I have a place of privilege in our industry. So I'm, as I heard someone put it, I'm male and pale. I'm a white male. I'm cisgendered. I'm heterosexual. I have, you know, an education. I grew up in a privileged social economic status. And the repercussions of me talking about this, I think, will be different or could be different than someone else who is maybe in a more difficult or more precarious position in our industry. So again, sort of realizing that, I was like, not just that it's, you know, it's helpful and important for me to talk about, but almost that it's necessary, because there will be people who will not be able to, or will not be able to without fear of reprisal. Then this is a thing that I can do, and it's a thing that I'm comfortable enough with, and I think can have a really positive impact. So yeah, almost the more that I do it and the more that I hear about people responding to it, the more motivated I am to do it more.
So you mentioned being able to speak potentially for about something that maybe other people don't have the privilege to. That speaks a little bit to me about there's some stigmas and misconceptions about mental illness, or I'm just wondering if you could speak to some of those, what you, if you've experienced anything yourself in terms of sharing something in the workplace, or what you think other people may be experiencing based on what people have told you after hearing your talk.
Yeah. So I don't have any direct experience with being sort of made to feel ashamed, or being kind of punished for being open about this stuff. I've been, I think, very lucky in that case. I think there have been people that have, and I think there are workplaces and managers who are less, let's say, open to appreciating or understanding these kinds of things. I think this is part of this sort of dichotomy that, you know, if an employee were to tell you they had a broken leg and couldn't come into work, nobody would bat an eyelash. But if, you know, if someone was dealing with a severe sort of mental episode that was temporary, but, you know, at the time was debilitating, I still think it would be very difficult. And I'm not even sure I would be super comfortable with actually telling my manager, like, look, I can't come in today because I'm feeling incredibly overwhelmed and I need time to sort of like rest and heal my mind as opposed to my body. And I, again, talking about this stuff hopefully opens up a bit of that awareness and makes people more open to understanding what other people are going through.
I think based on what you're telling me and a few experiences, I think a common misconception is that depression or mental trauma is visible.
Yeah.
Is that someone, you know, is crying in the office or something like that,
totally.
You know, and that's not necessarily the case. And I think that needs to be really emphasized.
Yeah, no, I think it's, yes, just that it's not necessarily visible. Again, there are people like me who can generally get by when I'm sort of like out with people or in public or at work. But that doesn't mean there's not a lot sort of going on under the surface. So yeah, it's definitely not always obvious. It's also, it's not a binary thing in terms of like you sort of are depressed or you're not, right? Or you're healthy or you're not. There's actually a model called the mental health continuum model. And I think it was in part developed with the Canadian Armed Forces. And the idea was to be able to get soldiers, it's called something like the road to mental health readiness. And it sort of talks about this spectrum of sort of states of mental health. And so you can be healthy and sort of like able to cope with things. You can be maybe less healthy, but, you know, not like, say, mentally ill. So I think their scale is sort of healthy and then reacting and then injured and then ill. And they, I think, quite intentionally make sort of a physical like analogy to how this can be, right? Like, you know, when we think about physical difficulties, there are different levels, right? You know, we can be in a great deal of physical pain. We can be in some physical pain that makes things uncomfortable, but we're still able to do things. So even for people that deal with this stuff, it's not even like every day is going to be the same, or every week is going to be the same, or every challenge is going to be the same. Yep. So even thinking that you sort of, you know, have some sort of handle on what people are going through, like even that's not stationary, right? That's not static. So acknowledging not only that you may not be able to see it, but even if you do see it, that doesn't necessarily mean you sort of fully understand it and how it's going to be and how it's not going to change. Because yeah, a lot of this stuff is very malleable.
So I had two thoughts. The first, I wanted to speak to your point about, you know, feeling even comfortable telling your boss you need a day off to just regroup or whatever your situation might be. It is a huge part of why I work for myself. I found myself when I was working, I mean, almost my entire career, I took a lot of time off and I had to have excuses for it because you can't just take a day off. You have to give the person, you know, your boss, some legitimate excuse about your, you know, medical history. And it was literally in our employee thing that a mental health day is not an option. I need like a physical note from my doctor in order to have a day off. So, you know, I photoshopped a doctor's note and used that to get out of jobs. To get out to days off, which that just exacerbates the problem if you're taking a day off because you have a need to tend to your mental or emotional well-being in a very real way. And then you're lying on top of that. So you're lying to someone you respect, perhaps, hopefully your boss that you respect, and you're lying to yourself. You may even have to lie to your colleagues. Like, it's horrible. And I just feel, you know, one of the things that I love about the freedom of working for myself is when I'm not feeling like I can, I don't. I find other times to get my work in. I can work with the schedule that adjusts to how I am as a person. The other thing I wanted to mention is about the misconceptions. I think another misconception is that if you're struggling with a mental illness or even an actual diagnosis of a disorder, like it's something that you can just fix. Like it's cheer up, or can't you just do it this way? You know, I've struggled with an eating disorder for as long as I really can remember. And it was never something that was ever looked at it always was something like, well, you could just fix this with dieting or things like that that actually exacerbate a problem versus help a problem. And it was only until I actually moved out of my household from my parents and was out on my own and started actually seeking help where I realized that there was a lot of stuff that I could deal with, but it wasn't like a quick fix. It was hard work and therapy to deal with that kind of stuff. And I think that's so challenging when you're trying to, well, when you choose to finally tell people about things like that, because they say you're only as sick as your secrets. You've got to be kind of open with the people in your life about what you're struggling with. But to get the deep empathy of what a struggle it is versus, oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I saw like a Lifetime movie about that.
Actually, this reminds me of before this episode, Jamie, you mentioned us bringing up a point that sometimes gets missed in this discussion, especially when we're talking to allies, is that a lot of people try to fix first.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Versus empathize first. Like, you know, Emily was mentioning about how it's like, oh, I have this eating disorder, have this issue. And then suddenly all this diet advice comes out of somebody's mouth. And that's not what you want and not even what you need. So I'm curious, Jamie, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So like I say, one of the reasons, and I'm not even sure I've even talked about this yet, but cognitive behavioral therapy is sort of an approach that I've used to a good deal of success in my sort of dealing with my depression. But I think part of the reason why it appeals to me and part of the reason why this is what I talk about in this presentation is because I think it really appeals to a kind of problem solver mindset. Like, I think it makes it seem almost like, oh, like, I mean, I call it debugging our feelings, which makes it seem like, oh yeah, I know how to do debugging, right? Like, I can make this seem very familiar to someone who sort of thinks like I do, a developer who solves problems the way that I do. The problem with having this kind of default problem solving mindset is that when someone comes to you in pain or, you know, telling you about difficulty that you're having, and this is 100% true for me, and I've really been trying to get away from it, but my initial instinct is to fix it, right? Like, I don't look at that as like, oh, here's a person who's struggling with something. I look at it as a problem to be solved. And I know from similar to your experience, like as soon as somebody sort of comes to you with not intending to be flippant, but what seems like this sort of quote unquote easy answer, right? Like just that, you know, you're struggling with this thing. Oh, I read this book. Just go read this book. Or like, oh, I watched this TED talk, right? And just watch that and you'll be fine. And it's like, if it were that easy, like that makes me feel worse because now like you just managed to figure out this incredibly difficult problem that I've been having for years in the span of 15 seconds. So like, what does that say about me, right? How have I not been able to figure this out? How did I not find that TED talk or whatever to watch and like have everything fixed? So this problem solver sort of default mindset, we kind of need to overcome it when, especially when we're dealing with other people and their challenges, that first and foremost, they're people. And that means they are feeling things and they are struggling with things. And that is probably more important than the problem itself. That acknowledging the difficulty that people are going through is even more helpful than thinking that you've solved their problem, because quite frankly, you haven't, I'm sure of it. But even if you theoretically have somehow magically given them this sort of magic bullet that solves everything, like they still don't feel necessarily better, right? They don't feel like they've been heard. They don't feel like they've been acknowledged. They don't feel like that problem has sort of been, you know, sort of seen to be a real thing, a real challenge.
Validated.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. It almost feels dismissed or minimized.
Yes.
If it's someone's like, oh, I read this book and you should check it out. It's like, you didn't actually hear what I told you.
Yes.
I think one of the things that's challenging, and I think this aspect is true regardless of whether, you know, you're trying to share, whenever you're trying to share something with someone on just like a human level, and if you're receiving it, I'm guilty, like you mentioned, you're guilty of it too, is sometimes it's just really hard to be uncomfortable, to feel like you can't do anything. And you just have to kind of turn it on yourself and tell yourself that the doing is the listening. Like, that is the best doing that you can do. And you may feel uncomfortable that you can't physically change it or you can't magically say the right thing, but that's just not how life works. So if everyone could get a little bit more comfortable with being uncomfortable, especially when they feel kind of helpless, that's how your friend feels or your loved one feels. And maybe that's all they need is to be able to talk to you. And, you know, you empathize a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's so much easier for me, right? If someone comes to me and tells me that they're in pain, it's so much easier for me to just give a quick kind of answer and then be able to wash my hands of it, right? Mm-hmm. Like you say, that I don't have to sort of struggle with the discomfort of really trying to empathize with that pain and that struggle that the person's going through. I can just be like, oh, yeah, just you just have to do this. And then I get to walk away and sort of continue with my day. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's easier for me. It's not more beneficial for the other person. But yes, it saves me from a lot of discomfort.
So let's talk about some of the specifics that you've talked about in your presentations. Can you share some of the personal experiences you've had, the strategies that you've developed as you've been seeking mental wellness?
Yeah. So like I said, I was diagnosed with depression about 16 years ago. And the doctor that I had at the time, I was prescribed antidepressants, so medication, which I've been sort of off and on ever since. But my doctor actually also prescribed a book to me, which is called Feeling Good by Dr. David Burns. And it's kind of a seminal text, I guess, on cognitive behavioral therapy. And he sort of said, read this book and it'll be helpful. And I realized, given the conversation we just had, that seems kind of flippant. But given this is my doctor and I went to him for help, I was more receptive, I guess. But it was a book that had an incredible impact on me at the time and one that I go back to regularly. So it's a book that teaches CBT, but also sort of like broadly, but then also gets into some of the specifics of how to deal with certain challenges. So sometimes I go back and just read a particular chapter. Sometimes I go back and read it cover to cover. So the idea with cognitive behavioral therapy is that our feelings and our responses are driven by our thoughts. So we have these experiences, right? Like, you know, stuff happens to us and we see things and talk to people. And then it can almost feel like it's that experience, the thing that happened that made me feel this way, right? That person cut me off in traffic and now I'm pissed off. Mm-hmm. What CBT says is that what's really driving that response is the way that you're thinking about that experience, so how you're interpreting it. And that's kind of the first part, is to acknowledge that there's this other step in that process and that it's our thinking that really guides, you know, so those responses that we have. And that means that we can do something about that, that because we have, as humans, have, you know, tendencies to fall into certain mental traps. You had someone on your podcast, Denise Jacobs, who talked about banishing your inner critic. Mm-hmm. And I was listening to it recently and I was like, oh, this is cognitive behavioral therapy. Like, I was like, your inner critic is like literally, cognitive behavioral therapy calls it self-talk. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that voice in your head that's telling you you're going to fail at this, right? Or this isn't going to work out, or these people don't think you're interesting, or all that stuff, that inner critic stuff. These are just traps that cognitive behavioral therapy identifies. They're called cognitive distortions. And so the kind of first step in CBT is sort of identifying those thought patterns and understanding how those thoughts can lead directly to having negative and distorted feelings. And taken to extremes, it can cause, you know, severe episodes like depression and anxiety. So a lot of what CBT is about is, again, like recognizing those patterns and then having tools to be able to adjust some of those thought patterns. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I found, honestly, like one of the most useful things about CBT is even just understanding that model and then looking at a kind of a list of those cognitive distortions. So again, the kind of like standard traps that we fall into And there are lots of lists of them out there. You can just search on Wikipedia for cognitive distortions and they give you a bunch of them. But, you know, there's, depending on what list you look at, there's 12 or 15 or 20. But I promise you, if you look at that list, you will see two or three or four and you'll be like, oh, yes, yes, that is exactly what I always do. I often fall into a trap called fortune telling, which is where you sort of predict something that's going to happen and then respond to that prediction as opposed to what's actually going on. So predicting that this isn't going to go well, right? Me thinking about coming on this podcast, right? I was predicting I'm not going to know what to say. People aren't going to find this interesting. I'm not going to be able to answer the questions. I don't know this stuff well enough. And all of that was based on this prediction. And it's a compelling enough prediction that I felt very nervous about doing this. But I was able to recognize, oh, okay. I see what's happening. This is fortune telling again, right? This is something that I've seen before, I'm used to, and can identify and now be like, okay, I know how I'm going. I know this path that I'm going down. And again, through a lot of practice in this, being able to identify that is often enough for me to sort of be like, okay, I can think about this differently. I don't know what the future holds. I don't know how this is going to go. And frankly, I can do preparation, right? I still have agency here. I can do something to make it so that that, say, possible future is not the one that comes true.
I think that last part is one of the, you know, if you do pursue therapy, whether it's self-driven or with a therapist or a psychologist or a social worker, I think it's that moment when you find that agency, where you realize that you actually have developed the tools to do something about it. I feel like that's the point, at least for me, where it really feels like you really learn something that's with you. It doesn't mean that everything's going to be okay moving forward. It's just that you know you can do something about it versus a feeling of helplessness, which I think becomes a big part of when someone is struggling with their mental health.
Yep.
So one of the things that I really liked about your peer's talk when you were explaining some of these CBT lists and moving forward and the actual tools, so far we've been talking about like vague ways over like, yeah, read the list and then you'll identify it and everything. But what I liked about your talk was you actually showed your notebook and how you applied looking through those lists. So why don't you explain to our listeners a little bit more about what I'm talking about?
Yeah, so this might work better with a visual. But yeah, so again, cognitive behavioral therapy is based on this idea that it's these thought patterns that cause us to have these responses that are unhelpful. So one of the most basic techniques in cognitive behavioral therapy is to actually just write down the thoughts that you're having. So if you're having a response that is interfering with what you want to do, you start writing down the things that you were thinking that caused you to feel that way. So again, for example, I was nervous about coming on this podcast, but what I was thinking was, you know, I'm going to fail, right? Or I'm not going to be able to answer these questions, or I'm not going to be able to answer clearly or effectively. And as you start to write those things down, and I should pause here and say, one of the things I do make a point of is to say, I mean, literally write these things down. I don't mean think hard about them. I don't even mean sort of like type them out. Yeah, I have slides in this presentation where I just took photos of my notebook to really drive home the point that like actually taking pen to paper is a significant part of this. Mm-hmm. There's a weird thing where while those thoughts are sort of rattling around in our heads, it's so difficult for us to try and get a handle on them, to try and kind of see them for what they are and not just be caught up in thinking or feeling that way. And the mere act of writing this stuff down actually goes a long way towards giving us some perspective on what's actually going on. It sort of makes it real in a way that nothing else does. And I'm not a psychologist. I don't know why that is, but I know that it's true. So yeah, you sort of write down the thoughts that you're having, and then you can start to look at them and figure out how they're distorted or, you know, what's sort of wrong with thinking that way in a sort of like in a rational sense. So again, if you sort of know some of the cognitive distortions from CBT, it's a bit of a shortcut to identify like, oh, I know this is fortune telling and that means this. But even if you don't, like if I'm sitting down, you know, thinking about how difficult being interviewed for a podcast is going to be, as soon as I start writing down like what it is that I'm thinking is going to happen, right? Or what I think, you know, the response of the audience is going to be, then I can start to write down like, okay, that's a way of thinking, but you know, the fact is, the truth is that I can't predict the future, for example. Mm-hmm. One of the other things, actually, I think in another one of your podcasts, Eric Regan talking about success and failure. And one of the points he raised was this idea of that success and failure are an event as opposed to a person. Mm-hmm. So we have this tendency to label ourselves, right? I am a failure, as opposed to say that project failed or I failed at doing this thing. So again, writing down something like I'm a failure, you can look at that and say, well, that's not actually a thing. I'm not a failure in the sense of sort of that's all I'll ever be and all I will ever do, because I've succeeded at things before, right? I can't be a failure if I've had successes. And this is an example of something called labeling in CBT, which is sort of where we call ourselves names like that. And it reduces us to this kind of two-dimensional trait or attribute mm-hmm. that seems like it just defines us when it can't possibly, just because of how complex and interesting we all are. So again, writing down like I'm a failure and looking at that and saying, well, no, that's not accurate, right? The sort of lie there is that I can't be defined by a single adjective. I can't be defined by a single label. And remembering that we're far more nuanced than that. And hopefully coming away from that thinking, okay, yes, I have failed. This is a thing that happened, but that doesn't define me. And I can come back from this and do something different next time or learn from it, right?
So this documenting of your whatever you're feeling and then sort of trying to tie it to these cognitive distortions, you know, to kind of force yourself to think about it differently. And what do you come away from that process from? Do you feel less anxiety or nervousness, or is it something that just the process of going through it is calming, or does it really change your perspective? Where does it fall on the scale of what you walk away from the exercise with?
So I think on a sort of case-by-case basis, working through some of those thoughts that you're having can help sort of with the immediate feelings or responses that you're dealing with. So mm-hmm. working through some of that thinking that you've been going through and coming up with kind of more rational responses to that thought pattern will help you feel better now. Mm-hmm. But it's also kind of practice for the next time that kind mm-hmm. of thought arises, right? And so you're going to write it down the next time and work through the same way and the next time and the next time. And again, eventually with some practice, like it becomes a lot easier to identify that, this is just one of the traps that I fall into often. And you can sort of recognize it earlier and deal with it earlier. Like recognize that, this is just me, fortune telling again or labeling mm-hmm. myself. And I know what that means. And I know what it does to me. And I'm not going to do that this time. Mm-hmm. And with some practice, and one of the things that often comes up in context of CBT is mindfulness. So practicing things like mindfulness that give you a bit of space, a bit of room to be able to reflect on how you're thinking and how you're feeling can be helpful with that. But yeah, it's a bit of both. It should help sort of immediately as you kind of realize like, the thing that I was thinking that's causing me to feel this way is not really real. It's not really rational. But this other way of thinking that is more realistic, well, now that I think that way, I don't feel quite so nervous. I feel maybe a little bit nervous, but I'm still able to get on with what I want to do.
I'm curious, we've mentioned a couple of times, you've referred to this as debugging. And I'm just wondering if you can draw parallels to sort of this exercise of documenting your feelings, trying to explore a different way of thinking about it, how that might tie to someone, a developer who is kind of like, what are you talking about? But yeah, it's kind of aligns with what they're already doing as part of their job and how they have to analyze problem and come up with a solution.
Yeah. So, the two main parallels that I draw are this model in CBT that has to do with, our experiences being kind of interpreted by our thoughts leading to our responses, our feelings, is not that dissimilar from how, say, a simple program works, where a program has input and then the code interprets that input and produces output. And when I looked at it that way, I was like, that's interesting that those seem quite similar. And when we're doing debugging of code, that generally speaking doesn't upset us a great deal, right? We do this pretty often. we test something, we realize it's not working, we go back and we fix it. And yet when we find ourselves reacting in a way that is sort of overwhelming and unhelpful, mm-hmm. we tend to get really stuck in it. So the first sort of parallel I wanted to draw was that if we think about it a bit more like how we do normal debugging of code, then we can learn that these are just thoughts that are causing us to feel this way and we can do something about them. You don't have to be sort of swamped or carried away by the way you're thinking and the way you're feeling. The other part of it, again, is like the cognitive distortion stuff is these patterns that we often fall into. And just like in debugging, if you work with arrays long enough, you start to identify off by one errors, you know, everywhere. If you work in CSS long enough, you get really familiar with specificity problems. Back in the day, we used to have box model problems when we were dealing with IE6. And what happens is the more you recognize those patterns, the easier it is for you to see their impact, right? Like you can see the bug for what it is. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to output a list and you're always missing the last item, well, that's an off by one error most likely. And now you know where to look in the code, right? You've got to find a loop, got to find an array, and you can know, you can figure out how to fix it really easily. So again, the idea of these cognitive distortions is the same kind of thing, that we tend to fall for the same traps. So being aware of what some of those traps are make it a lot easier for us to identify what's actually going on in our heads and how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. See, I love this.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a really good analogy because it does seem, you know, my partner is a developer and, you know, he thinks like a developer just the way I think like a developer. But that's also kind of a problem when we communicate emotionally because they seem like very different things when you're coding and solving problems versus when you're sharing feelings and trying to solve problems there. But they do have a lot of similarity. And especially with a CBT approach, really knowing those cognitive distortions and getting to learn them, it's like learning the fixes or the hacks. It very much is. I think it's a great analogy.
Yeah. And I mean, and again, for specific ones I talk about in the talk, dealing with something like, say, perfectionism. So perfectionism often has to do with a distortion called all or nothing thinking, which is where we sort of work in black and white. Mm-hmm. And perfectionism is a lot like that, right? That you sort of feel like unless my product is perfect, it's garbage, right? Unless it's completely bug-free or unless it's, you know, completely refactored, I don't want to put it out there. Mm-hmm. So there are sort of ways specifically of testing for some of those distortions. So again, for all or nothing thinking and perfectionism, one of the things I talk about is just sort of keeping track of the things that you do, just tasks like, you know, I'm going to demo to a client or I'm going to submit a pull request. And on a scale of 0 to 100, sort of how effective you feel you've been at whatever that thing is. And then once it's done, on a scale of 0 to 100, how satisfied you are from it. So based on how you feel, based on how the client feels, whatever it is. And it helps identify when we're starting to think in this black and white way. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we often think like, unless something is 100% perfect, right? I've done everything I possibly do, then like that satisfaction should be zero, right? That's sort of like the extreme example of perfectionism. Often we tend to kind of slowly walk the path there of, you know, I'm just going to add this one feature before, let me just fix this one little bug. Let me just refactor this method. And, you know, we carry on and on and on and don't ever actually get anything released because we're too worried about, you know, fixing all these little things. But keeping track of that and noticing that there's not a correlation like that, that when, even though we sometimes feel like we haven't been super effective at something, there's still a level of satisfaction, right? The client mm-hmm. still gets at least part of what they wanted. And you can start to help like calibrate yourself on how you're thinking about those things. And again, be able to identify when you're falling into that trap, but also as a reminder of like, of when, or at least how inappropriate it is to sort of bear that like all or nothing mindset mm-hmm. when you're sort of working on project stuff.
So one of the things about CBT that I think kind of aligns with how developers approach things is kind of what you're describing. The work that you have to do to support the exercises, to do what you're describing, to sort of develop a toolbox or an expertise in your own ways of thinking, it takes time, but it also, you're gathering data. You're actually gathering information about yourself that you can really challenge your thoughts against, you know, if you're journaling or, you know, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, if you're keeping track of what situations and prompted something or how you were feeling before and then after, and then you can compare what the reality was versus the anticipatory anxiety kind of stuff. And it's somewhat data driven, your own data, if you're taking the time to do all the work to sort of seeing these patterns in a very real way, as opposed to it's just something you're reading about. You really do have to do this kind of hands-on work.
Yep. And I think, I mean, again, CBT for me, we talked a bit about the sort of immediacy of web development. Because cognitive behavioral therapy is very focused on tools and techniques and things that you can do right now, I've been to different therapists at different times, and I've gone through a bit of psychotherapy where it's, you know, a lot of talking about my past and my parents and my childhood and all that kind of stuff. And for me, that didn't appeal or didn't, I guess it didn't connect with me. And part of the reason why I think CBT did was that immediacy, was that, you know, when we have a sort of bug to fix in our code, we aren't super concerned about all the reasons why we got to this point. We just want to fix the thing, right? I just want to know what to do now. It's fine. We can like postmortem later and figure out why this kind of thing is happening, but right now we need to fix it. And CBT is very much interested in like, these are the thoughts you're having right now that are causing these feelings you're having right now. And this is what we can do about them right now. And it's less important, at least in terms of cognitive behavioral therapy, sort of why those thought patterns are in place. They are patterns. They may be habits. They may have a reason for it. But right now you're stuck in feeling this way. And here's a thing that you can do right now today that will help you with that.
So I'm curious, you kind of hinted about other therapies that you're using. And obviously, we've been talking a lot about CBT, but I'm curious about what other approaches you've used to tackle your mental health issues that you think other people listening can utilize.
Yeah. So the one piece of advice that I always get from my doctor, which I hate getting it because it's true, but is that your physical health and your mental health are very connected, right? So like every time I go to my doctor, they're like, she asks me, are you sleeping well? And have you been eating well? And are you exercising? And I'm always like, no to any of those things. And she always reminds me, and like nicely, but she reminds me that like those things are very important, that to build a foundation for mental health, that you kind of have to have that foundational stuff in place. And it's easy to forget and easy to get sort of like, you know, caught up in work or whatever else it is that we want to do, or even sort of kind of like self-indulgent behaviors, especially when you feel bad, right? Yeah. When you're not feeling very good, it's the very last time you're thinking like, oh yes, now is when I think I should start a gym regimen. It's like, no, now is when I should watch Netflix and eat ice cream. Like, so that's the first part. Like, again, having that sort of foundational stuff in place, it's the like, again, it's the most sort of banal advice that you're going to get from a doctor, but it's also the truest. For me personally, I've sort of been on and off antidepressants. I've done sort of CBT as kind of self-study. I've also worked with therapists at different times on CBT stuff. I did work with one therapist on sort of psychotherapy. And all of those things have sort of had varying degrees of usefulness for me. The one thing I want to say about this is if you are really struggling, if you're suffering with something, there can be a lot of help from just doing anything, like literally anything that breaks whatever the kind of habit that you're in, whatever the kind of state that you've been in, sort of giving yourself, I've heard it called giving yourself a head fake, because our lives are built a lot around habits. We, you know, go to work at the same time. We, you know, go the same direction. Our day-to-day work is, you know, often pretty similar. We go home at the same time. That anything you can do to break up some of those habits, even if it seems really trivial, can help sort of like shake your head up a little bit and help to sort of give you, again, a bit of that space that you might need to sort of get perspective on what's going on. So in terms of, say, therapy and therapeutic resources, I mean, first and foremost, I'd say try literally anything. That if you need help, then don't get hung up on like what the right way or the best way or the way that I'm suggesting you do it or somebody else is suggesting you do it. If you find something, try it. If it doesn't work, try something else. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so I've tried other things. I've looked into something called acceptance and commitment therapy, which is a bit of a response to CBT and kind of talks about instead of engaging with those negative thoughts and trying to sort of fix them, it's more just accepting that, you know, we have thoughts and we have feelings and that's all they are. They don't control us. They aren't who we are. And almost like looking at the stuff that's going on in your head, like you're watching a movie. So instead of being sort of super wrapped up in it, it's about just being okay with the fact that sometimes we're sad or nervous or afraid or happy or grateful. Those things are all fine. And being more at peace and calm with just our nature. So yeah, again, kind of anything you can find. Yeah, ACT is of interest to me right now, but CBT has done a lot for me. They're both, I think, really interesting. CBT, I think, is one of the kind of de facto approaches that medical professionals will take these days when dealing with depression and anxiety. I think it's pretty well established. But again, that doesn't necessarily mean it's right for you. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's, you know, what you need right now. But if you're looking for something, it's not a terrible place to start.
I did CBT for most of my time that I've spent in therapy. And it was effective initially, especially because I really struggled to even identify what I was feeling. And there were exercises just to help me figure out what feelings were. I just thought I was angry all the time, but that there were other emotions other than anger. But over the years, I found that it wasn't solving the main problem that I was having. And just by chance, this wasn't, it's kind of what you were saying. I reached a really low point and I just reached out for somebody to help. And I found a therapist who did something I had never done before. It's called brain spotting, which is a relatively new therapy, and it kind of takes off of some of the approaches that are associated with the EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. But essentially, for me, it is about going deeper, because the CBT that I had done hadn't actually resolved some of the trauma I needed to resolve first. And the brain spotting, it kind of works by, instead of a talk therapy or exercises that I'm doing to identify my emotions and kind of process my thoughts differently, it's happens in session with a trained therapist. And it uses the idea that our autonomic nervous system can be affected by our emotions and memories and negative traumas from the past. And that in therapy, if you can trigger these neurological responses and process memories while that physical or physiological response is happening, you can desensitize the emotion. And essentially for me with brain spotting, we would identify a spot, literally, that if my eye found a certain spot that tended to feel like it elevated a sense of, if we were focusing on, you know, a particular childhood trauma, you know, if that increased my sensitivity by focusing on that spot, I would only look at that one spot and just talk. The therapist isn't talking back to me. She's not prompting anything. It's just me processing whatever had happened during that period, whatever this memory was. And with this sort of fixed eye position, somehow triggered some stuff that I had never been able to deal with before and was dealt with in a single session. Right. As crazy as that sounds, but not dealt with in the sense like, oh, I'm never going to have that problem again, but that this sort of locked in trauma that was feeding some of the negative thoughts and behaviors that I was having, I had to kind of deal with that first where I am in my life in order to then kind of apply some of the more, I think, very practical strategies of CBT, because it was holding me back. But I thought that that was a really interesting kind of approach, whether it's brain spotting or EMDR. Just there are other therapies that really do try to tie your emotional and thinking person, that part of you, to your physical body and help your physical body also sort of let go of the feelings that your body actually gets and memorizes based on your previous experiences to sort of break that tie.
That's fascinating to me. And absolutely, I mean, the reason why I talk about CBT is because, again, I've gotten a lot out of it. And I feel like I have, again, this sort of, you know, these analogies that I can use to teach it to, say, developers. But by no means, you know, do I think that it's the only way or the right way or, you know, necessarily even the best way. There's so much more out there, and whatever connects with you, it makes total sense. And again, it, like you said, if it's CBT now and it's not later, that's totally fine too. Mm-hmm. I feel sort of the same way that CBT got me a very long way, but now I'm starting to feel like, yeah, there's more that I need and CBT is not it, which again is why I was sort of looking at acceptance and commitment therapy, doing a bit of psychoanalysis, that kind of thing, to see if there was, you know, if I could address some of those other things that maybe CBT wasn't helping me with. Mm-hmm. So yeah, absolutely, whatever works, and what works now may not work later.
Yeah, that was basically what I wanted to point out a little bit earlier. What I like listening to both your stories is that being proactive and self-aware is so, so important. And also even understanding that what used to work no longer works mm-hmm. is also super important. And I feel like, you know, throughout this show, we've been making a lot of physical health analogies, and it really is the same thing. It's kind of like, let's say you're trying to become more fit, and what worked for, say, getting rid of the first 10 pounds and like helping you, you know, become your cardio better or whatever, is not going to work out if later on in your fitness journey, right? Like if you're trying to become more strong or trying to become faster, the first leg was just to get you out of a troublesome spot. Mm-hmm. Now the next leg to actually be healthy or healthiest is might require a completely different approach.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I think it's worth putting out there, because this is something that I was surprised at the beginning when I first started seeking help. is it took me a while to find a therapist that I connected with and felt was helping me. I think it's kind of like finding a doctor. I'm still trying to find a doctor that I like for my annual physicals and stuff. But sometimes you luck out and, you know, maybe the person that your insurance supports, you hit it off right away. But sometimes it doesn't. And I would just suggest that if it doesn't, don't give up. Don't assume that therapy isn't right for you or whatever. I do think that there is an important, you need to like the person you're dealing with. You need to feel like they're getting you and that what they do, how they approach things is going to help you. You need a few sessions at least to figure that out. And if you don't feel that way, you should try and seek someone else because it's expensive to seek therapy. That's just the truth.
Yeah. And I'm Canadian, so it's maybe a little bit different in the States. But I think my last two employers, my current employer, my last employer, you know, we have health benefits that include being able to seek out mental health advice to get hooked up with a therapist and get a certain number of sessions covered by our benefits, which I've used multiple times, not just here, but in my last job. And again, like it's sort of whatever they can provide. I think you're absolutely right about finding a therapist that really fits in terms of their approach and their personality with, you know, you and how you want to go about this. But like I say, I've used those resources to find a therapist, sort of any therapist at a given time, just because I felt like it was something that I needed. Mm-hmm. And in most cases, I haven't found a therapist where, you know, I've really wanted to work with them long term, but that doesn't mean it wasn't sort of even helpful a little bit in the short term to help me, like just to have someone to talk through some things and to sound off and, you know, someone who's an actual professional and knows how to deal with this stuff better than, say, I do.
You know, we're getting close to the end of our episode, and I just wanted to make sure that we get some of these last questions in. What do you think? I don't even know how to phrase this because it sounds weird to say what I'm going to say. How can we support the mental health of our industry as a whole? Because it kind of assumes that this is something that we all do collectively. Is that possible?
So as I've been sort of going through this myself and sort of researching for my talk and things like that, I found there are groups out there who are working towards this, who are trying to sort of open up the conversation in our industry, make it less stigmatized and provide resources for people. So for me personally, you know, again, part of the reason why I talk about this stuff is to do that on an individual level. But there are groups like Open Sourcing Mental Illness, who they do a sort of tech industry mental health survey, I think once a year, every other year, and they have a bunch of resources on their site. There's a group called Prompt, which has a number of speakers who they can get set up at different conferences, if conference wants sort of someone to speak about mental health. So, you know, there are groups out there like that. Actually, this week, well, the week that we're recording, so the week of October 2nd, is also, you mentioned it being sort of Mental Health Month, Awareness Month. There's also something called Geek Mental Help, geekmentalhelp.com. And so this week is Geek Mental Help Week. And so again, they have a website where they're posting articles and blog posts and podcasts and anything, like any resources that people are generating this week for this kind of thing. So very much like getting the word out, making it, again, less stigmatized, more open about the fact that these are things that we're dealing with. I think, you know, that focus on the tech industry is one thing. I mean, this is not at all just the tech industry that struggles with this. Anecdotally feel like there's a sort of higher level of incidence in our industry. I don't know whether that's supported by research, but it feels like, you know, again, as soon as I start opening up about it, the number of people who come to me and say, oh yeah, you know, I've gone through something really similar, or, you know, oh, I'm on this medication. Which medication are you taking? Or like, oh yeah, I've tried that therapy, but what about this one? Have you tried this? And like the number of people who have real personal experience with this stuff is surprising. And I don't know, again, if there's something about our industry, but yeah, it feels like, you know, focusing on our community and removing that stigma as much as possible by talking about it, having groups that are working towards it makes a big difference.
Yeah. I feel similarly to you about that this might be prevalent in our industry, but I wonder if it's any industry where so many people are disconnected, you know, physically. You know, how many people do you know that you know only online and you don't actually get a chance to interact as much? You know, our jobs can lend itself to long hours of isolation, and that might contribute to it. I think that would be true in any kind of industry, like the trucking industry. Oh my God, I can't even imagine how isolating that job must be. But things like that, I do think the point you're making about being more open, having more speakers at conferences that address this, having more people talk about it just so people feel less alone, less isolated, that this is a human problem, not a there's something wrong with me and just me kind of problem, is a really big part of supporting destigmatizing it and supporting people to feel like that they can reach out for help or reach out to just talk.
So, Jamie, can you recommend any resources for our listeners who want to learn more?
Yeah, for sure. So in terms of cognitive behavioral therapy, the book that I mentioned is called Feeling Good by Dr. David Burns. Again, it's incredibly highly regarded in the sort of mental health industry. You can search for it, find it anywhere. I talked a bit about acceptance and commitment therapy. Again, it's just something else that may resonate better with certain people. There's a book called The Happiness Trap by Russ Harris that I've been looking into that I quite like. And if sort of reading a book or sort of working through exercise on your own isn't sort of the best way for you to do it, there's an app that I've been using recently called Pacifica, which is sort of cognitive behavioral therapy based. It adds in some mindfulness stuff, but it gets very nice and guided in terms of sort of having you check in on a daily basis about how you're feeling, what kind of thoughts you're having, you know, setting goals for yourself, which can be very beneficial in terms of, like, you know, figuring out whether you're getting towards where you want to be. It has sort of meditation techniques that sort of that work with some of the other things that it's teaching. I found it really interesting and really useful. I mentioned sort of, you know, geek mental health and open sourcing mental illness. There's something else about just finding other people that you can talk to about this stuff or hear about other people's experience. So I know of a couple podcasts where this is kind of the focus. There's something called the Mental Illness Happy Hour podcast. Here's a weird thing. So Mental Illness Happy Hour, the host sort of talks about some of their experience. They interview people who've had mental health issues. They get people to write in about some of the stuff they're going through. Honestly, listening to it, I don't listen to it a lot. It actually makes me feel guilty for not being depressed enough. Yeah, kind of, which is, that's a weird thing. So I have listened to it. I don't listen to it a lot in part because that makes me really uncomfortable and I don't find that actually helpful. But I think for some people, again, hearing that there are all these other people going through similar experiences is really useful. I've also found, so I don't know if other people are into this, but Slack groups that are, you know, based on people in our industry. And what's really interesting is I've joined a couple Slack groups, not for this reason, but ended up finding they've been the best place to talk about some of this stuff. So there's a group called We All JS, which is about, well, mostly JavaScript development, but has a real bent towards kind of sort of healthy interactions and sort of mental safety and being really open about talking some of that stuff. And so I've almost gotten more out of that than the sort of like coding and JavaScript side. There's another Slack from a guy named Rans, Michael Lopp. He has a Slack for sort of leadership in technology, but again, they have a really active mental health channel that it's honestly, it's the channel that I spent the most time in, despite the fact that I'm now a manager and joined the Slack because I wanted to learn how to do that better. but finding other people that are going through similar things that you can bounce ideas off of, and especially like we talked about, who are sort of ready to be empathetic as opposed to like other people have gone through this, you know, it's a lot easier for them to relate to what you're going through and understand that, you know, what you need is not a simple fix. It's just to be able to express this stuff, to be heard, to be acknowledged. Those things would be really helpful. So finding some sort of community like that can be a really big deal.
Great. We'll get links to all those in our show notes. And I also wanted to just mention some of the other links we'll include in our show notes for resources. So we'll have, or I guess I'll just pronounce the URL. So there's the suicidepreventionlifeline.org, the veteranscrisisline.net. This is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. It's for the U.S. government. It's www.samhsa.gov. That same site has a behavioral health treatment services locator in case you're looking for something in your area. And then, of course, we'll have links to Jamie's presentation as well.
Okay, well, this was such, it was a great episode. Like, it was really lovely to hear both of you be so open and honest about your experiences and the way you've both dealt with mental health issues. And I think, and I hope that if there's somebody out there struggling and they're listening to the show, that this episode could prompt you to seek help, any of the resources that we've mentioned. And, you know, thank you so much for joining us today. But before we finish up, we do have our rapid fire 10 questions so our listeners can get to know you a bit better. Are you ready?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. First question, introvert or extrovert?
I'd say introvert.
The power is going to be out for the next week. What food from the fridge do you eat first?
Whatever I could barbecue. I would just start barbecuing the hot dogs, the hamburgers, vegetables, whatever's in there, like on a barbecue.
What's your favorite website for fun?
I've been going, this is sort of a simple answer, but I've been going to YouTube a lot recently and just sort of watching content from some of the people I find really funny.
What's the last thing you read?
The last book I finished was a book called The Lathe of Heaven by Ursula K. Le Guin. I started a book after that I didn't finish because I didn't like it.
Fair. What's the best piece of professional advice you've received?
My dad, a long time and has reiterated since that, sort of told me that I'm sort of the only one that's going to look out for myself, which part of me thinks is kind of cynical, but also like it's a good reminder that, you know, you can't expect things to sort of come to you, that we have to do the work to sort of get out there and you know, achieve those goals. They aren't going to come to us.
How about the worst piece of professional advice you've received?
I don't know. If I got bad advice at any point, I probably cast it off. I don't remember.
What's your favorite color?
Blue.
If you could take us to one restaurant in your town, where would we go?
I don't know. I'm really not a food person. I have friends that I would ask.
If you were coming to visit, I'm disappointed.
I know. If you were coming to visit, I would ask my friends and then I would get you a very good recommendation because for me, it's about going to places that I can take my son, which limits my options.
What's your favorite board game?
Oh, it's a game called Avalon. I'm a big board game geek.
All right, last question. Hulu or Netflix?
Netflix. I don't even think we have Hulu in Canada, do we?
I don't think so.
I don't know.
Yeah.
So yeah, simple question.
So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate that you're doing this, that you're talking about this. I know it's, it's difficult stuff to talk about, but again, like, you know, expanding that conversation makes a big difference. And the fact that you're doing this month, I think is a great thing.
Thanks, Jamie. That's kind of what we were hoping for. So in case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
Yeah, so I'm Jamie Strawn on Twitter. That's not spelled how you'd think. It's JamieStrachan. I'm also jamiestrawn.ca. That's my website.
Okay, excellent. Thanks a lot, Jamie. This really was a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
Control Click is produced by Bright Umbrella, a web services agency invested in education and social good. Today's podcast would not be possible without the support of this episode's sponsor. Many thanks to the .all Conference.
We'd also like to thank our hosting partner, Archistech.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about Control Click, make sure you follow us on Twitter at Control Clickcast or visit our website, controlclickcast.com. And if you like this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both. Links are in our show notes and on our site.
Don't forget to tune into our next episode when Leia and I decided that we didn't have enough of the domestifying episodes. So we're doing another one. This time we're going to talk about web maintenance for clients. Be sure to check out controlclickcast.com/schedule for more upcoming topics.
This is Leia Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Clickcast. See you next time.
Cheers.